translation. When Devaki saw her brother actually repentant while explaining ordained events, she was relieved of all anger. Similarly, Vasudeva was also free from anger. Smiling, he spoke to Kamsa as follows. Purport. Devaki and Vasudeva, both highly elevated personalities, accepted the truth presented by Kamsa that everything is ordained by providence. According to the prophecy, Kamsa would be killed by the eighth child of Devaki. Therefore, Vasudeva and Devaki saw that behind all these incidents was a great plan devised by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because the Lord had already taken birth, just like a human child, and was in the safe custody of Yashoda, everything was happening according to plan, and there was no need to continue their ill feeling towards Kamsa. Thus they accepted Kamsa's words. Oma Gyana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Meditam Jaina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Hare Krishna, everyone, and good morning. We have to decide here, well, the acharyas have decided for us, whether this is one of three things. Either Kamsa is genuinely repentant, he has just, we're coming into the story where he's killed six children already, right? And he has been exposed as being very afraid. And he's been shocked to discover that the seventh child that he tried to kill was none other than a goddess who appeared in the sky in front of him and said, "You fool, the child which will kill you has already been born." And we have to decide whether that's a case of, you could say, pre-smashana vairagya. Smashana vairagya means the funeral realization that he's dead and she's dead and I'm going to die, and therefore shouldn't I be a little more detached from that which gives me pride? Detached from that which gives me temporary pleasure or temporary sense of enjoyment or control or feelings of power. Should I not be free from that? And it's very easy to be a self-realized person a few minutes after a funeral, especially of a loved one or someone who was also powerful and happy and proud. It's very easy for that realization to set in. And there's no one ready to listen to scripture more than a person just after a funeral. That's why our devotees can go and they can preach fearlessly. And even our youngest devotees can go to a very hard-headed crowd and they sit there and they speak what they've learned from the Bhagavad Gita, and everybody nods very sagely and thinks this person is so self-realized. It's a very easy time. Therefore, when, who was it? Yamaraj appeared. What was that occasion? Who appeared as a young boy? Kindly remind me. He appeared on the battlefield as a young boy. Who was that? Was that Yama? Yama, and what was the occasion? What was the battle? Oh, Hiranyakashipu was telling the story. Okay. I shall immediately run to my room after class, run back to my house and look this up. So Hiranyakashipu is telling the story. And he's saying how this young child appeared on the battlefield and was speaking words of comfort, that for the soul there's never birth nor death, nor having once been. Old translation. Does he ever cease to be? So that is actually very uncomfortable news when you're sitting on the beach in Ibiza, sipping your drinks with your sunglasses on. Very discomforting. Don't preach to me. Speak to the hand. I don't want to know that. But the same thing is very comforting when you've just lost your best friend or your partner or someone who was very important in your life. It's very comforting that they live on. But you can't have the comfort without the discomfort. Prabhupada said that that is your problem in the Western world. He said you are followers of the Ardha Murgi Nyaya. Ardha Murgi Nyaya. Murgi is chicken. Ardha means half. And Nyaya means logic. He said the logic of half a chicken is that the farmer had a chicken that was laying big eggs, making him a big profit in the marketplace. But the chicken was bigger than all the other chickens, so it was eating much grain. And so the foolish farmer, he took an axe and he cut the chicken in half. And he said, well, I'll keep the back part because that's where the eggs come from and I'll get so much profit. He said, but the front end is costing me so much money, I'll throw that away. He said, the farmer ended up with nothing because of his desire to keep what he thought was profitable and get rid of what was unprofitable. He ended up with nothing at all. So in the same way, Prabhupada said that we do this to the process of yoga. I'll keep this part. This part's very nice, but I'll get rid of this part. Okay? I'll keep the postures, but I'll get rid of the celibacy. Because that part is obviously troublesome, but that part is obviously pleasing. Okay? It'll make me nice and fit. So he said, you take the axe of your logic and you cut the chicken of yoga in half. He said, you'll end up with nothing. He said, he's just like the doctor in hospital. The doctor says, I'm sorry, you've got this disease. You're going to have to take this medicine. But we've coated the medicine with a nice sugar paste, so it tastes all right, tastes of banana flavor. You'll have to have this. He said, but at the same time, you'll have to give up fried food, you'll have to give up drinking, and you'll have to give up smoking, and you will have to get out and exercise. Oh, no, no, no. He's a very bad doctor. I don't like that doctor. He's very bad. I know another doctor who told me just to take the medicine. That's what I like. Okay? I'll go to my Ayurvedic doctor. He just told me to eat spinach and drink these powders. He said, I don't like this allopathic medicine where they teach you to give up things and go and have exercise. So we do that to the process of yoga. So everybody likes tantra. We like tantra. Sting likes tantra. We've all heard of tantra. We all think we know what it means. Actually, tantra is a very, very complex process. It's like we all like the 10th canto. At least in India they do. I don't know. Prabhupada issued that warning, and I never really understood why Prabhupada issued that warning, because I did read the 10th canto. If the guru says, don't read the 10th canto, the disciple immediately goes to the 10th canto and says, let me see. Let me see the bits that I'm not supposed to read. I was always puzzled. Well, which bits am I not supposed to read? It doesn't seem, it's not exactly Lady Chatterley's Lover. It's not an erotic text. It's Krishna dancing. And yet, we are warned, don't become worshippers only of the Dashama Skanda. Read the 9 cantos, so that when you do come to the 10th canto, you'll understand. So that is the medicine that you must take. That is the restriction that you must take. So we are devotees of the Srimad Bhagavatam, not simply devotees of Krishna and Radha playing in a bush in Vrindavan. Prabhupada said, if that is what you want, you will never find. And therefore, in the Gaudiya Mat, they have that expression. How does it go? Anyway, I forget. But always keep the Rasa Leela of the Lord ahead of you and above you. Pujala Raga Pata Gaurava Bhange. Yes, Pujala Raga Pata Gaurava Bhange. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was, this was his message. And Prabhupada had a very strict message also to prevent what often happens with neophyte devotees. They very easily become sahaja because they easily think that they have discovered Krishna. And upon the first flush of devotional sentiment, they think, aha, I'm directly reciprocating with Krishna. Krishna is directly reciprocating with me. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur calls this utsaha mai. Utsaha mai. It's like when you're teaching children Jagadatri, and you come and you teach them an A, And then the next day you come to teach them an A and they go, I know, I did this before. You don't have to tell me. The children are like that. Utsaha mai. Vishwanath says that it's like the Brahmin child, and he knows one letter in Sanskrit, and then he thinks he knows everything. So this tendency is there. It's there in children, and it's there in neophytes. If you've just taken to Krishna consciousness, the tendency will be that you are a Kanishta Adhikari. The tendency for the Kanishta Adhikari is Utsaha Mai, to think that you know everything, when actually you know something. What you know is fine. That's great. I'm not the body, I'm spirit soul. Prabhupada is the boss. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There. Yeah. And that the whole philosophy can be knocked into a matchbox. Okay, I understand. You don't have to tell me anything. But we see many people come and many people leave. Why do they come and go? Utsaha mai. And if they'd stay on a little bit longer, tarangarangini. Tarangarangini means now you're really surfing. Okay? Now you've really started to enjoy the waves. Okay? You're reaping the benefits of being a sadhu. People are coming, they're throwing flower petals at you. They're giving you a very long name. They're banging a drum whenever you get near them at the airport. Okay, now you've really arrived. You've reached the final pinnacle, the ultimate pinnacle of Krishna consciousness. Okay? And this Vishwanath Chakravarti says, whoops, this is a big problem. He said, for this reason, one of the Caesars, Marcus Aurelius, he paid someone to stand nearby him and say, you are just a human being. You are just a human being. And very regularly, he would pay that person to do it. And it was a very dangerous position, because at the height of your triumph, you don't want a guy saying, yeah, but you're just a human being. Come on, give us a break. And to this day, when the Pope of Rome, who was a Caesar, took over and became the Pope of the Holy Roman Empire, that tradition has stayed. So when you see the Pope on the balcony, you'll always see a man behind him saying, you are just a human being. You are dust. This is all dust. So it brings him down to a good level. Because otherwise the mind is turned. 15,000 people standing in front of you, all looking at you going, Papa, Papa, Father, Father. Okay? Could go to a man's head. And so it does. And so it went to Kamsa's head. He was only a human being. It went to his head. And he, you know, he was just an ordinary person, but he'd put his own father, Ugrasena, in prison. Now, I have a confession to make. A shock confession. I've been reading Srimad Bhagavatam for more than 40 years. And quite some years ago, maybe when I'd been a devotee for about 8 years, I went through a struggle because I thought, is Srimad Bhagavatam embellished storytelling to attract us to Krishna? Or is it really literally true? And I looked at some of the characters, and you know, in this country of England, we have a tradition known as pantomime. If you're from another country, look it up. Pantomime, it means a play in which each of the characters is very much embellished. So the bad guy comes on, and the whole audience boos, and he's a lovable bad person. And he's always got a mustache that he twirls like this. Mustache is an emblem of pride, isn't it? It's vanity. And he twirls his mustache, and he goes, and everybody goes, boo. So, and the good person comes on, and everybody goes, hooray. And the good person's impossibly good, and the bad person is impossibly bad. And I looked at Kamsa, and I thought, yeah, but who would be so bad that they would put their own father in prison? Who would be so bad that they would kill the children of their own sister? Who would be so bad that he thought that he could defy God? And I had a little bit of reservation in my heart also about the story of Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, and I thought, well, maybe these are, you know, just maybe, these are stories that are a little bit extra inflated. Maybe the art of storytelling, somewhere along the line in Indian history, has caused people sitting around their campfire to just puff it up a little bit. You know, just a little bit. Just for the minds of the rather unintelligent who are gathered there. Of course, I'm still here because, like Kamsa, I had to have a revelation of how stupid I was. Luckily, the spiritual master, when we have that revelation, and we must have that revelation in order to approach Krishna consciousness from a fresh angle with a fresh vision, either that revelation comes as a epiphany, a one-off shock revelation, or it comes as a gradual elevation. And one day, Prabhupada says, just like being on an airplane, you stop speaking to your friend and you look out the window and you find that you're 5 miles high in the sky. How did you get that high? You don't know. Gradually, gradually, gradually. So in Krishna consciousness, he said, gradually, gradually, you come to that level and you discover, yes, everything in the Bhagavatam is true. And the bits that I don't know, those bits I accept because I accept the remainder of it. I was, Prabhupada wanted us to distribute the Krishna book. And you might think, well, Krishna book is the 10th canto. But all the purports from all 9 cantos you will find in the Krishna book. It's a standalone scripture. It is the 10th canto, but expressed with 9 cantos worth of purports in the purports to every verse. So you can read the Krishna book and you'll get the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. That's why Prabhupada wrote it in such a way. So very early on, we were distributing Krishna books. I think it must have been about 1976 or something like that. 1976, maybe. Maybe it was a little bit more. But I remember being in a place called Rotherham. Rotherham. And the technique we had at the time was to distribute daffodils. And we would go out with a big box of daffodils. The things you had to do. Things you had to do. Maybe it was a little bit later, actually, because that was one of the things that we had to do to
pay off Bhaktivedanta Manor that wasn't actually given to us. Shock revelation.
There was a
hidden bill.
So we the legend. Let the legend remain as it is. I just know how many daffodils I had to sell. So we would go out with daffodils, and hello, this one's for you today. And we thought to speed up the process, we would go on top of buses and make an announcement. So on top of a double-decker bus, I had a lot of books, and my shoulders couldn't cope anymore with all these Krishna books. I mean, it was a wonderful burden of love. But the difficulty was, it was so heavy. And some of us weren't doing well with such a heavy weight. You know, Back to Godhead magazine was a little bit lighter. Perfection of Yoga was a little bit lighter, but you had to go out with Krishna book, and it was just, you know, huge, great thing. And in those days, they hadn't invented trolleys, shopping trolleys. We were still shopping baskets. Anyway, we stood on top of a bus in the bus station in Rochdale. And I remember this very clearly, with a box of daffodils saying, "Hello, everybody. Today is Daffodil Day in Rochdale. And we're distributing these daffodils so that you can help all the unfortunate people subject to the miseries of birth, death, old age, and disease." Okay? So I, you know, gave out a daffodil. People threw in money. And then I gave out Krishna books. And the whole top deck, we gave out Krishna books. I gave out Krishna books. And at the end, there was a woman in the back. She'd just given 10 pence, but I'd given her, you know, in a burst of mercy, which was not really mercy, it was motivated mercy, by my shoulder was really spelling how much mercy I should be giving out. So I gave out the mercy, and as I got ready to leave the top deck, because at that time the bus was moving and I didn't know where we were, and I had to jump on another bus to go back to the bus station. And she stood up, and she was a rather large woman with 2 children and her hair tied back in a ponytail and scrunchy. And she shouted down the hall, and she had a voice. you know, foghorn would be a generous description. She had a voice, and she said, "You mean I've paid 10 pence to read about the Rasalila?" And I looked at her and I thought, yeah, that's pretty much the sum of it. You have paid 10 pence to get the highest essence of the absolute truth. I said, yes, don't worry, you'll love it. And she sat down, I disappeared. But this was her protest, that I have paid 10 pence and you've given me the Rasalila. However, moving on, why did we get stuck on that? Krishna book. So Krishna book is there. Krishna book is there to be read. If you haven't read it, please do read it before you leave the Krishna consciousness movement, which statistically half of you in this room will do without reading the Krishna conscious books. There are 5 books that you should read. Prabhupada has said you should read the Krishna book, Bhagavad Gita, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Nectar of Devotion, Ishupanishad. One more. Prabhupada said different things at different times. He ultimately said 4 books is all you need to be a devotee and to make others devotees. Very simple. Now, you know how many books we have? I was astonished. How many books have been written by followers of Srila Prabhupada, both disciples and grand disciples? We're nearing about 800. So when you walk into the average Krishna temple, ISKCON temple, you're confronted with a vast maze of literature. But I beg you, please read Prabhupada's books, because he wrote those books for you. Sometimes I don't think that he wrote them for me. I only got a chance to read them later on. But the first thing was, sell them, sell the books. You already know the philosophy, I was told. Sell the books. So here we have a situation where we have to decide, is Kamsa for real, or is it just pre-smashana vairagya? Is he just being shocked? Has he had a real change of heart? Well, luckily in this purport, we find that Devaki and Vasudeva are elevated personalities, and they have agreed that that Kamsa is telling the truth. He's telling the truth. He's genuinely repentant. He's genuinely repentant. Was he genuinely repentant? Huh? Was he genuinely repentant at that moment? Yeah. And then what happened? Bad association, yeah. He hung out with Narada Muni. If you're going to hang out with everybody, just hang out with Narada Muni. Isn't it very interesting that as preachers, we often look to see, you know, what does it mean to preach Krishna consciousness? You know? What does it mean to write about Krishna consciousness? We have controversies over books that are written by devotee preachers sometimes, don't we? Should this book be sold in an ISKCON temple? Should we read this book? Is this book meant to be read by neophytes? Is this a too high of a book? We have controversies over literature. Well, Narada Muni is the best preacher. And all of us really are servants of the servants of the servants of Narada Muni. His preaching technique is that look at who is sitting in front of you and preach accordingly. Preach accordingly to that person, to that particular audience. So when he's with Magrari, the hunter, what does he do? He says, kill animals, but kill them completely. This is a higher principle. Okay? It's like sometimes we have to tell people, all right, eat fish. In my preaching, I have to tell people, eat fish. Okay, eat fish. Why? Because they say, I can't give up meat. So then you say, okay, you're bargaining with them. Okay, can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? We're asking for something. We are beggars of Dharma. We're asking, please give me a small scrap that represents for you an improvement. Otherwise, we become a very cloistered, religious organization whose message is not fit for anybody except those souls who practice bhakti in their last life. There are a few. There are a few. Maybe you're one of them. Do you practice bhakti in your last life, and maybe a few lifetimes before that, and you come to Krishna consciousness very quickly. You come very quickly. The change of heart just happens just like that. You see the devotees, and immediately you think, I've got to have more of this. What are they singing? What's this all about? Yeah. And the devotee preaches to you, and you say, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, this is great. This is just what I've been looking for. But most people are not in that. Most people are not in that category. Most people are the yes but school of thought. Yeah but. What about this? And now we even find, I'm finding anyway, that devotees that move into the ashram, it's an immersion experience. If you live in the ashram just for some time, that's why Mathura Vas. Living in a place where there's devotees, living in the place where there's Krishna. Maturavas is such a powerful Maturavas, or Mayapuravas, or Vrindavanvas is such a powerful, or Mandiravas, you know, is such a powerful principle. But now 98% of our devotees, they don't live in the temple for any particular amount of time. They never get what we used to call ashram training. There's no immersion experience. So sometimes I find, even with devotees, it's yes, but what about, yeah, but what about this? Yeah, ISKCON, but what about, yeah, but gurus, what about this? That conversion never takes place within the mind. And they remain speculators and sort of people who are deciding permanently whether they fully want to give themselves to Krishna consciousness. So there's a gray area here. And as preachers, we have to be like Narada Muni and to help people step through that gray area. And it takes, one time Prabhupada spent a few minutes saying to his devotees, maybe it was Los Angeles, maybe it was another place, he said, it takes so much blood to bring one person to Krishna consciousness. And he looked at them and he was silent. He said, and then he said it again. He said, so much time, so much trouble, so much effort to bring a person to Krishna consciousness. And he said it again, so much blood to bring someone to Krishna consciousness. He wanted them to know what he was going through to bring them to Krishna consciousness. I don't know what Prabhupada was thinking when he looked out at a room full of devotees here at Bhaktivedanta Manor. I don't know. I wonder sometimes. I wonder what Prabhupada was thinking. I had that occasion. I was standing right there. And Prabhupada was on the Vyasasana. He was Jai Om Vishnuvada Varamahongsa. So everybody bowed down. And I thought, I've got to get Prabhupada's attention. I don't know when he's going to leave. I've got to get Prabhupada's attention. I want him to look at me. I want him to recognize me in some way. So I just stood up. Actually, I just didn't bow down. And I just stood. And I looked at him, and I was the only person in the room here standing. And Prabhupada just looked. And we went all the way through the Premadwani prayers with Prabhupada looking at me and me looking at him. And afterwards, and I did bow down, right at the end I bowed down. And afterwards I thought, why did you do that? Why did you stare your guru out? Because Prabhupada eventually looked away, and I thought, I don't know whether it was a look of disgust on his face or, who is this person? What does he think he's trying to do? Who is he? You know, everybody's bowing down. But you don't know. You never know. You never know. But I'm sure that sometimes Prabhupada was, you know, sometimes he praised us and he said, you're all yogis. He said, well, if you go out to distribute one of my books, he said, this is better than 1,000 years in the Himalayas meditating. He said, just to distribute one book. He said, this is better than thousands of years of meditation. And we took that and we believed him. We believed him. And then sometimes he would say, you are all less intelligent. You're all very unintelligent. You see, the guru can do that. The guru can do that. Prabhupada said it's like a pot. It's like a pot. He said, just like in Vrindavan, the man is making a pot. His hand makes a fist. And inside the metal, the fist goes. And then he has a little hammer. And he's tuk, 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 tuck, tuck, tuck. He said, from the inside, he is pushing and reinforcing and keeping it strong. And from the outside, he is making little changes. So this is the guru. He's saying words. Don't do this. Do this. Wash your hands. Don't touch your nose. He said, pick up your bead bag off the floor. Don't do this. Don't bow down like a frog. Keep your hands clean. Why is your gumcha so dirty? Why are you so morose? Why is your tilak wrong? So he's tuck, 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 making little changes on the outside. But at the same time, he's got his hand inside. And this is not the fist of anger. This is the fist of love. This is the fist of support. And he's supporting you. So the bowl waller, he's making the pot waller, he's making, because he has this. If he only has hammering and there's no support within, then the bowl will be crushed by the blows of the hammer. If there's only this inside, you're my old dear disciples, I love you metal, you're very wonderful, you're copper, you're so bright, you're so shiny, but there's never any banging, you'll only have a sheet. Nothing will change. So the guru has to do both. He has to be like this, but tuck, 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 like that. And this is difficult because disciples, we like this, Ardha Murgi Nyaya, half chicken. We like this part, but we don't like that part. How are you, my disciple? That's so wonderful. You've done so well. You've been distributing books. That's wonderful. Wonderful. You're all wonderful. Everything is wonderful. And the guru goes away. Nothing has changed. You see? So the art of a preacher, and the guru is the sum total of all preaching capability, is to deal with the person in such a way that they are lifted up and then reshaped. Yes, reshaped, remolded in some way. So that has to be there. So what's happening here? This is a very great drama. So I was telling you that I thought that Kamsa was a pantomime character. But actually, in my life, I have seen so many despots, so many tyrants. And as Kali Yuga goes on and on and on, you don't have to look very far. We've become very interconnected now. Years ago, I didn't know what was happening in Russia. When I was a child, when I looked at the map of the world, where Russia is, you couldn't even see anything. It was a big gray part of the map. China, it was gray. It was just empty. We weren't even allowed to go there to find out where the rivers were. Nobody knew what was happening in China or Russia. And they, one devotee from East Germany, he told me, when he was growing up in school, they looked at a map of West Germany and there was nothing on it. No towns, no cities, no rivers, no mountains. It was just, you weren't even allowed to know what was going on the outside. You see? But now, something happens in Yemen, or China, or Arkansas, or, you know, anywhere in the world. And you know about it on the same day. So we have a sort of despot Qatar, tyrant Qatar. We hear from different parts of the world about all the time about people who are killing children. Every day there's something in the news about some child being killed by those who should love them the most. So the idea is, at least in India, the person who brings you in for your wedding, on your wedding day, is not your father, but the person who loves you even more than your father. Who could that be? It's your mother's brother, your mama. Your mama brings you in. And he's the one who's in bits. He's the most emotional. But how is that possible? And here's the mama Kangs. And he's the one who is most agitated. Not only in the beginning did he seize Devaki's hair, but then as the children came, even knowing full well that child 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 would not kill him, still Narada Muni, he said to him, forget that. That heavenly voice, even the heavenly voice, might have been lying to you. You see? And then when you're not a trusting person, when you have no fundamental faith in human nature, when your trust in human nature has been so shaken, you project that out and you can't trust anybody. So he repents, and after a few pages we find that he loses that state of repentance. The lesson here is that if forgiveness is a brahminical quality, if someone truly repents and comes to you and says, I'm sorry for what I've done, I'm sorry for what I've said, okay? The churlish, low-spirited nature says, oh, no, don't think you can come back here bowing down and, you know, I'm not, you know. Forgiveness is even more powerful than that hate, than that anger. So forgiveness is a spiritual quality. It's the quality of the soul. Of course, we have to know two things. We have to know two things. One is paramarthika, and one is vyavaharika, or lokika. And paramarthika means our highest welfare, our highest, you know, our highest, the highest knowledge. So, for instance, everyone is a spirit soul. So I will never take part in the Chinese dog-eating festival. I won't take part in it. Why? Because just like me, dogs are spirit souls. Cats are spirit souls. Everyone is a spirit soul. And yet the sages say, at the same time, Vyaviharika logic says that when that spirit soul is in the body of a tiger, you should not embrace the tiger. You may see Brahmani Gavi Hastini, you may see everyone equally, but please don't embrace the tiger, because the tiger will kill you. Because you see spirit soul, but the tiger sees lunch. And that is the difference. So you may choose to see everyone as spirit soul, but how you behave may be different. I choose to see everybody as spirit soul, but in social organization, in principles of social organization, the people are of different natures. So people of different natures, birds of a feather flock together, and they like to do certain things together. And so Krishna, the very person who says that everybody is a spirit soul in the Bhagavad Gita, he also says, Chaturvarnyam mayashishtam gunabhaga vibhagashaha, gunakarma vibhagashaha. So that everybody has a nature. And they don't give up that nature very easily. And so when we're trying to get along in the world, don't embrace tigers. Don't embrace tigers. But some people will really like it that you see them as a spirit soul, and some people will hate you. And that is why sometimes our devotees are placed in difficult situations, because the way they see the world is not the way a tyrant sees the world. And a tyrant very easily will lock you up or kill you. There are some parts of the world where the presence or just the form of a devotee is an anathema to the way they lead their life. So we must be cautious, but at the same time, not give up on love. And that's difficult. Don't abandon love and trust. As soon as you see it, you should immediately reciprocate. But at the same time, if someone does imagine themselves to be your enemy, you don't consider them your enemy, but you behave with a little bit of caution. And that's difficult to find the balance sometimes. And sometimes religious people are the first ones to go. I was speaking to, well, I was doing some research and about the, it's for one of our devotees, telling the life story. And there's a particular country where the opposing army came in, and immediately the first thing they went for was the priests. You kill the priests, you kill the intellectuals, you kill the teachers, you kill the doctors, anyone with a natural position, you kill the judiciary with a natural position of authority, you see. And this is what all demons will do. You naturally kill the religious people first, because religion is very powerful, because love is very powerful. It's the most powerful thing. So if you can, if you have love naturally and you care for people naturally, you'll be a very powerful person. And a person who wants power will see that as a threat. So the first thing you do is get rid of religion. Now there are countries in the world where not only religion is banned, but the word God has been got rid of from the dictionary. Only one country that I can think of, and I won't mention any names, but you open the dictionary, you will not even find, because if you remove the word, you'll also remove the concept. So Kamsa imprisoned his father, Ugrasena, and then he married, who did he marry? Even before he married, he married on the advice, he had bad advice. This Chanura and Mushtika, they weren't just wrestlers. Chanura was his advisor. And he said, look, if you really want to be powerful, you marry the daughters of the king of Magad. So he married Asti and Prapti, and they were the king of Magad's daughters. Who was the king of Magad? Jarasandha. Jarasandha. And that's why Jarasandha, he comes and he, you know. So Jarasandha. So the point here is that everything Kamsa did was political strategy for power. And religion got in the way of that. Krishna got in the way of that. Krishna is the very emblem of religious life. So Kamsa, there was nothing that he wouldn't do to prevent Krishna and the devotees of Krishna. And so therefore his character is not an exaggeration. There we saw in some Middle Eastern potentates, it's very, you know, to kill their own son was not, if their own son was against them, they killed them. You know? Who was it? Was it Shah Jahan? Shah Jahan killed his own father? Aurangzeb killed his own father, okay. Who was Shah Jahan? Huh? His father. Aurangzeb's father was Shah Jahan. Okay, so who got killed? Shah Jahan. So Aurangzeb killed his father. So killing the father, killing the son, killing the children. Nothing will stop a person who's blinded with rage. Rupa Goswami said, for the conditioned soul, there's only two things. Avirodha priti, which means unrestricted attachment. Completely unfettered, unrestricted attachment. Nothing that I see that is beyond my grasping power. But he said, from that comes avirodha yukta krodha. The anger, the intense anger that comes when you can't get what you want. And material nature will always arrange, just when you think that you've got it, to have it snatched away from you. So whatever it is, whatever it is, the whole point is that the material world is a place of learning. And the lesson is that you can't have it. You can't have the material world. It is just like you cannot have a reflection of a mango in water. So you reach out for the mango, and as soon as you touch it, it dissolves. So whatever there is, and sometimes it's quite ironic and poetic. You know, sometimes the way fame is snatched away from someone, or power is snatched away from someone, and it's called yoga brashta. Yoga brashta means that they achieve something so high, and then yoga brashta means they come falling down. They go from hubris to nemesis, and we see this in the world, whether it's political leaders or monarchs. Whether it's Romania, Ceausescu, he was at one time, he was high above everybody. Within half an hour, he had been pulled from his position and was killed. Half an hour is all it took. Now, rightly or wrongly, we see people in the Middle East, within a matter of days, they go from being the leader of country to being discovered in a hole or a drain pipe. You know? So this world is very cruel, very, very cruel world. And it is cruel. It is crueler to those who want to exploit it. But even to those who don't, even to those who have understood to whom everything belongs, you know, even in our small kingdom of ISKCON, you can't have fame. You cannot, as a devotee, fame will come to you. But Raghunath Das Goswami, as we were hearing the other day, what does he say that when fame comes to a devotee, what is it? It's donkey urine. And no one wants to bathe in donkey urine, given the choice. You'll have a nice hot shower. Prabhuji, would you like to bathe in donkey urine? We'll make special arrangements. So fame comes to a devotee, but the devotee has to avoid it. Power comes to a devotee, but the devotee has to avoid it. Wealth comes to a devotee, the devotee has to avoid it. Because it'll be your undoing. Because these Dhanam, Janam, and Sundarim, these are the very things that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, spoil the life of a devotee. Dhanam, Janam, and Sundarim. Dhanam, Janam, and Sundarim. It's not that something has changed in 500 years, and somehow or another I can be a devotee with Dhanam, with Janam, and with Sundarim. You can't have it. You can't have both. Because as soon as you have it, the tendency is that I want it, I see it, I must have it. And you lose everything. Not only what you had, but what you would have got as well. So here's Kamsa in the process of losing everything. Here's a man who's down on his luck. And here's what we're seeing, it seems, is a very brief respite. But even with the very brief respite, Vasudeva and Devaki, being the devotees that they are, being the mother and father of God himself, they're saying, yes, all right, we accept. We accept. We accept your... Because they're saying, yes, this is genuine. Yes, it may have something to do with an eight-armed goddess telling him that he's going to die. Yes, it may have something to do with the terrible guilt that he must be feeling. Something. So in this way, these life stories, and there's even a temple in the place where this took place. It is called the Mahavidya Devi Mandir. The Mahavidya Devi Mandir. If you go from Krishna's birthplace, from the new birthplace, where they put up a mosque, to the old birthplace, where they didn't, and down the road, you will see that they are still have cloth wallas. For 5,000 years, they've been dyeing cloth in that area. So the streams in that part of Mathura are still running red and purple and green as people are dyeing cloth. If you then take a right and you go around the corner, you'll see steps leading up. And this is the Mahavidya Devi temple where they say that this incident of Kamsa seeing Mahavidya Devi or Durga Devi, Ambaji, and being so intensely shocked that he says, all right, this is way beyond me now, that Mother Nature herself has come to tell me that the child who was going to kill me has already been born and is living somewhere else. It's time for me to repent. But he had a brief repentance, and then we shall see what happens. And the continuing story. I don't know what happens next. You better come to the next Srimad Bhagavatam class to find out. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.